Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this special program of the Southern Alberta Council on Public Affairs. It's a special week because we are meeting twice this week, today, Tuesday, and again on Thursday, when our speaker is going to be Paul Hinman of the Alberta Alliance. And so we're hoping that you will come again and do a change of hat and a change of gear and put your provincial thoughts in order and listen to what Mr. Hinman has to say about Alberta politics, which is different from today when we're going to be talking federal politics. Peter McCormick from the University of Lethbridge is here with us today, always a favorite at public affairs, as we can tell by the number of people who have joined us today on a special day. Now, Peter, as you know, is at the University of Lethbridge, and I should read the right one. He holds a degree from the University of Alberta, University of Toronto, and the London School of Economics. He's fascinated by the issues that have been emerging in this election, as is everybody else. And after the debate last night, I know we have a lot of things we would like to hear Peter's take on. So I would welcome Peter. Thank you.
Okay, well, even though I'm speaking from notes, this is still just a series of random thoughts and gloomy conclusions about the election campaign that we're going through right now. I think a few issues ago, the English news magazine, The Economist, had a piece about Canada. And basically, this major article, their basic conclusion was, Canada was a great country, a whole lot of things were going right, the only problem was the politics was broken. And I do think that's basically the message that we should be carrying this election campaign. All we're going to see over the next 2 weeks... Never works. Okay, crouch down. Speak louder, whatever. I think all we're going to discover over the next 2 weeks is just how broken our politics is, because I'm not looking forward to any particularly happy outcome. What's broken about our politics, of course, is the party system. Parties are an important part of democracy as we have developed it. They're in trouble everywhere in the early years of this new century, but they're the only device we have these days for making democracy work. And our party system is in real trouble. Parties are the mechanism that bridges the gap between citizens and governments. They're the mechanism through which we can hold governments to account. But that accountability device only works if you can throw out a present set of rascals out of office, if you got a new set of rascals lined up ready to take their place. Our problem has been making sure we have two sets of rascals to choose from. The great political story in Canada during the 1990s was the destruction of the Progressive Conservative Party of Canada, the first party of Canada, in the aftermath of Brian Mulroney. It's only because of the void left behind by the destruction of that party that the Liberals have been able to stay in power as long as they have despite all their problems. It looks like the great political story of this decade is the damage that Jean Chrétien has done to the Liberal Party and how close he has come to destroying the Liberal Party. So in the space of two decades, we seem to have gone from having two major national parties able to fight from coast to coast to having zero, and that's quite an accomplishment. The drop from 2-1 is bad enough. The drop from 2-0 is catastrophic. Now, it's really surprising how fast this particular storm blew up. You roll the clock back 5 years, and especially if you support the federal Liberals, life is just absolutely wonderful. There's, no problems anywhere. I mean, Chrétien has just finished rolling to a third straight majority government win. And the sovereignists seem to be very much in decline. The Liberals beat them in 2000. They took more seats than the Bloc. The Bloc, their membership was falling. Their support was falling. Provincially, the PQ was swept out of office decisively by Jean Charest's Liberals. I mean, things are looking awfully good in Canada 5 years ago. The only fly in the ointment is the fact that Chrétien and Martin, the great 1-2 team that took the Liberal government through the 1990s in such good shape, intensely dislike each other, and the intense dislike is starting to break out in the open. Now, I do want to keep going back to this event because it is absolutely without precedent in Canadian history. What we saw in Canada in the early years of this century was a palace revolution. It was a bloodless coup d'etat. Paul Martin took the Liberal Party away from a three-time successful prime minister. Yeah, just to describe it takes your breath away. How on earth could you do that? But that's exactly what Paul Martin did. Chrétien did not want to step down when he did, but Martin's complete control of the party machinery was so transparent and so obvious that Chrétien had no choice but to step down voluntarily or face humiliation at a party convention. He took a few measures of revenge on the way out, but basically what you saw was a coup d'etat. What you saw was the leader of a democratically elected majority government forced out of office. I mean, just, we'll be talking about this for ages as an exercise in something. We'll decide what eventually. All that happened, Chrétien had this enormous long goodbye, right? I'll leave, but not for months and months and months. And all that seemed to do was to make it more of a coronation. It just heightened the atmosphere of the king is coming. The king is just around the corner. Great things are preparing themselves. And the only question we thought was how big the Martin landslide was going to be when we finally got another federal election. Well, of course, that's not quite how the story turned out. There were three things that went wrong for the Liberals, and the three things together have put us in the corner we've got right now. The first thing was that the right finally managed to get its act together and unite. And on my reading of it, Joe Clark had prevented that for about 6 or 7 years, and the net result of that was to give Jean Chrétien the gift of facing a divided right that tripped over itself periodically in the province of Ontario. I don't think it mattered much outside of Ontario. I think it mattered a lot inside Ontario, and Ontario was the key to Jean Chrétien's three-peat, his three successive elections. And that was, in large part, a gift from Joe Clark. So Joe Clark delayed it, but finally, as we get into the new century, the right manages to get its act together. It was a marriage of convenience rather than a love match. The vote share of the new party was rather less than the sum of the parts from the previous election, so it wasn't a complete success off the bat, but at least there was no longer the distraction in Ontario of a divided right that made life easier for the Liberals. That's the first thing that went wrong for the Liberals. And so far, the new party seems to be holding together, even though the last 18 months have not been unalloyed joy for them. They're the major fracture lines that were potential, and Stockwell Day showed us how fast a party on the right can develop fracture lines. The fracture lines that were always possible never materialized. So in a way, they've survived their first test of fire without screaming at each other, which in any marriage is always, the first test, right? The second thing that happened, and a very important thing, was the civil war that broke out within the Liberal Party. So not only did we have a coup d'etat, but the losers bore grudges. And that's an astonishing development, and I really do want to emphasize that. The Liberal Party is the most successful political organization of the 20th century, not just for Canada, I think for the world. The Federal Liberal Party has a success record that I don't think any other Democratic Party can match. And since Alan Saroff from my department isn't here, I say that with confidence, but he'll get me tomorrow. It's a massive success story. They've been incredibly successful. But there are two things that being a successful party involves. Number one is you hold disparate groups and personalities together with all the compromises and trade-offs that requires. And number two, the critical test, is leadership succession. You prepare for the handing on of power. Because the handing on of power from a successful leader to the next one is always the moment of greatest vulnerability for any political dynasty. The Liberals have been very good at that. The perfect example is Pearson's recruitment and grooming of Trudeau when Pearson went out of office and Trudeau came in. That's the succession, taking care of succession in spades. The Liberals have been good at it. This time around, they got it completely wrong. It took a palace revolution to squeeze a leader out and put a new leader in. And on the way out, on my reading of it, the outgoing leader made sure to get even with his successor. This is not how you handle succession. And the best example, the most perfect example that I think we're going to see play itself out in the next 2 weeks, the Liberals' last chance to turn it around, is Jean Chrétien's wonderful transformation of election campaign financing, the brand new set of rules. No corporate donations, public funds instead. Now, you can make all kinds of nice philosophical arguments for it. We'll make the practical argument right here and now. Which party benefited from the new rules? The new rules are you get money every year based on your vote share from the last election. The more votes you got, the more money you got. And you can't go to corporate interests to get extra money over and above it. You can go to individual donations, small donations, but that's all. Okay, the party that benefited the most from the new regime is, incredibly, the Bloc. The Bloc has never had it so good. The Bloc thinks they've died and gone to heaven. I mean, they've never had a fraction this much money to spend during election campaign. From some indications I've heard, they've switched off any attempt to raise campaign funds at all because they don't know what to do with the money they've got. This flows automatically from the new regime. They don't need to do anything to watch the money flow in, and they don't know how to spend that much because they're only running in a quarter of the country, so it really contains costs. It's a wonderful situation for them. And one effect of it was it clearly in the first half of the campaign, the party that made by far the most effective use of television was the Bloc. Their ads were slick, smooth, professional. They worked on every level. And the other parties all lined up back, and most of them well back, from what the Bloc was doing. Well, money is not the only explanation for that, but it sure helped. So the Bloc is the big winner. The party that has lost the most is equally clear. It's the Liberals. I mean, we all talk about, the Conservatives. Everyone in this room knows the Conservatives are the party of big business. But curiously, the party that gets the money from big business over at least the last dozen years has been the Liberals. So if you ban businesses making big donations to government, the party that loses the income is the Liberals. So the Liberal, Jean Chrétien shot the Liberal Party in the foot by restricting their most effective way of gaining money. They did get public funding, a nice big shot of, we won't talk about how much, it would depress you, but they got a nice big shot of federal money, but the Conservatives got almost as much, and the Conservatives, unlike the Liberals, because contrary to the mythology, they don't have a lot of big buck major corporate donations. The Conservatives have spent the last decade getting really good at raising little lumps of money from large numbers of people, and it adds up over a period of time. So in this election campaign, completely unlike the last one, the Conservatives have more money to spend than the Liberals. Last time, the Liberals had way more money to spend than the Conservatives. That's one reason the Liberals managed to turn it around in the late going. They had lots of money to pour into a really splashy TV campaign. They don't have that much money this time, and this time the Conservatives can talk back. So the dynamic promises to be quite different. Now, no doubt you can make nice, profound philosophical arguments for this, but the practical effect is Jean Chrétien made things even more difficult for Paul Martin and his Liberals than he needed to. Getting even with your successor is not how you handle a leadership succession. Now, in case any of you missed it, the third thing that happened was the Gomery inquiry. I assume that explains itself and we can now just go on. I mean, going into the 2004 election campaign, I think the basic reading of it would have to be that Paul Martin made a glorious, wonderful, time-delaying, damage-controlling move by promising to have a judicial inquiry. And that got him, that was one of the things that got him through the 2004 election campaign. The trouble with time-delaying mechanisms is all they do is delay it. They don't make it go away. And so the Liberals got to spend the whole next year having a massive center stage, right up front expose of the most sordid corners of the federal Liberal Party. Day in, day out, week in, week out, replay of old stuff, suddenly some new stuff, then replay of old stuff. I mean, it's a death of a thousand cuts if you're the prime minister, and it just seemed never to end. And of course, the major casualty in all this was the Liberal Party's hard-earned and basically well-deserved reputation for managerial competence. It's awfully hard to maintain that illusion when Gomery is the lead story in the news week after week. So, and also the casual arrogance that kept showing up in the hearings just hit the public mood exactly wrong. Now, of course, Paul Martin was never directly linked with the mess, but the Liberal Party he had inherited definitely was. And, of course, during this election campaign, the very worst thing that's happened to the Liberals is, first of all, the Ralph Goodale, the income trust investigation by the RCMP, and then this latest, by-blow of the Canadian Unity Council. It's not that either one of those amounts to a hill of beans in itself. I don't really think they do. It's just that it reminded the public one more time of how often in the last 3 or 4 years you got to read a sentence that had the word liberal and scandal appearing in the same sentence. And the answer is way more times than you wanted. It's exactly what the opposition wanted and the government didn't. But I think inside Quebec is where Gomery is having the most damage on it, and the one with the most long-term implications, and this is my biggest source of gloom and doom that I will share with you on this glorious day. The sovereignist movement seemed totally in eclipse in 2000, 2001, 2002. All of a sudden, it's been restored to vigor and vitality, and that is entirely this the Sponsorgate, the ad scam, the Gomery Inquiry. That has created the rebirth of the sovereignty movement inside Quebec at both the provincial and national levels. And it's the greatest godsend they could ever have asked for. They never dreamed of this when the century started. The Bloc did extremely well in the 2004 election. It seems poised to do a bit better this time around, although they did so well in 2004, they ain't got no growth room. That's the only thing that will limit their gains this time around. I think any projection of seat totals for the Bloc over 60 is just sheer fantasy. They're already at 54, so their gains will be 4 to 6 seats. But still, if you're the Bloc, you're not losing from your previous high point. This counts as good news. And provincially, the PQ has got a new leader. Jean Charest is exploring depths of public unpopularity, previously unvisited by a Quebec premier. Things look awfully good for them when we have a provincial general election in the province of Quebec next year. Of course, that's a long time away. 16 months is the minimum count for the next Quebec provincial election. An awful lot can happen in 16 months. And by the same token as well, I know that a vote for the PQ or the BQ in current circumstances is not necessarily a vote for sovereignty. But my sad thought is it's a heck of a good start. You know, if you're the Bloc or the PQ, you'll take your half loaf and try to turn it into a full one. It's way better than the nothing at all you had 4 years ago. So I think if the Liberals take another whomping in the province of Quebec in 2 weeks, and they will, and the PQ wins big in next year, and they probably will, then I think you're starting to get close to the winning conditions that the sovereignists have driven us crazy mumbling about for the last few years. And whatever party takes more seats next Monday, which is the drama we're all waiting for, I think the net outcome is the same. A weak minority government in Ottawa that has no credibility at all in the province of Quebec, and we're building up to the next referendum campaign. That's the scary, that's what's going on in the background of the fun we're having just now, and that's the part that worries me. Now, so far the campaign has been very contained, very low-key. Another word would be boring. It's been replete with promises of all kinds of goodies, and carefully targeted on a block of voters that each party thinks is available to it. If you, open up the party platforms, you can find which group of voters they think might move their way. Now, this may seem a little unusual to us after a decade of austerity politics, where it's sort of, your government promises to make you bleed as little as possible or something. And now we're back in the good old days of goodies for everyone. This is just a return to business as usual, folks. This is what democratic elections look like. It's the promise competition. One of the things that's intriguing for me is how much of this campaign has been fought within the territory of provincial legislative jurisdiction. I'm sorry, I teach constitutional law. I get hung up about these things. So we've been talking about health care and daycare and university tuition and funding for cities. Please, somebody mention a piece of federal jurisdiction for me soon. This was all a provincial election campaign. I mean, all of this is provincial. All Ottawa can do is throw money and hope the provinces are in a friendly mood when they catch it and do something along the lines of what the feds had in mind. The niceties of the federal-provincial division of legislative authority seems to be completely lost upon the dynamics of federal politics these days. So I guess if you want a debate about foreign policy, you need to wait for the PEI, provincial general election. Maybe they'll talk about it there. Now, without question, that low-key quietness is about to change. I hope you enjoyed that part because it's over. It's increasingly clear that the Conservatives have solidly won the first phase of the campaign. The poll numbers are moving in their direction in a promising but not yet a decisive way. Martin's quite right to shrug it off and say this is exactly where we were last time, and still he managed to turn it around. Two things to bear in mind. Number one, bear in mind this is implicitly suggesting the very best the Liberals are hoping for is a really shaky minority government. There's just no better news for them anywhere, and even turning it around means just barely staying alive. The second thing to bear in mind is if you read between the lines of that statement, the way they turned it around was an extremely negative bit of advertising for a couple of weeks. The way the Liberals got it, held onto office in 2004 was by scaring people of what the Tories would do if they were in office. What I read into Martin's comments is that they are going to try the same thing again this time. And this time, since things are, if anything, slightly worse than they were last time, it's going to have to be at least as nasty. So, you know, look for some negative advertising. If not, I think the Liberals are just going to drift. Their campaign has been surprising so far for its lack of focus and its lack of drive. It hasn't really seemed to know where it wanted to go. The other parties have had a much better idea of what they're doing. If the Liberals don't pull something out soon, and I can't believe they won't because we're talking about the most effective political machine of the 20th century, if they don't pull something out soon, then it is over now. Just a question of how much. But I don't think it's over now. We can expect the Liberals to start spending the money they've been saving, and the Conservatives start spending the money they've been saving, and you're going to see an awful lot of this election campaign on your television screens outside of the news hour. I think that's what's coming. Now, where are we going as an outcome? Okay, I'm an academic. I do it this way. There are five different possible scenarios, some of which are more likely than others. The first scenario is the normal situation of the 1990s. Remember, before Paul Martin launched his coup d'etat? The situation in the 1990s was a Liberal majority government. Now, at first glance, if you just looked at seat totals and nothing else, you'd say, that should be on the card. The Liberals, you know, came out of the last election with 135 seats. That's pretty good. You know, what's a majority in the House of Commons? 155. Run the math. How many seats do you need to gain? 20. Well, 20 is pretty hairy. Better to get 30 and have a bit of a margin for error, but still, you know, not an enormous number of seats. They ought to be there. The thing is, I just don't have any idea where those seats would come from. I think the Liberals are going to lose a handful of seats in Quebec, not enough to matter because they got whomped so bad last time. This is always the advantage of a bad showing. You know, things can't get a whole lot worse. I think they're going to lose more seats in Ontario. I don't know how many. That's the drama you get to watch on election night. And I think they're going to win a handful of seats back on the West Coast. That's a loss. However you run that, that's a loss. If the Liberals really campaign well now, they should be able to hold their loss to single digits. Still a loss. I don't see a net gain at all, especially not a net gain of that magnitude. So I don't think that one's going to happen. The second scenario is the other end of the scale, a Conservative majority government. And certainly at this point in the campaign, you could get enthusiastic about that possibility. The Conservatives are doing well. Things are consolidating. They survived last night with nothing blowing up. That's really all they were aiming at. Things are looking great for the Conservatives right now. However, the Conservatives entered this, you know, last election, they took 99 seats. That means you need to gain about 60 new seats in order to become a majority government. The only place you can go fishing for that, you know, there's that many fish in the pond for you to go looking for, is in the province of Ontario. That would mean you'd have to sweep Ontario the way Jean Chrétien did right through the 1990s. I don't see it. I mean, you know, fine, things are moving the right direction. Fine, seats are going to change hands. Fine, the Tories are going to gain. They're not going to gain 60 seats in the province of Ontario. You heard it here first. If you're going to go down big. This is always my motto. So don't see that happening. So however promising things are at this point in the campaign, and it's got to be about as good as any Conservative Party organizer thought they could be at this point in the campaign, I don't think a Conservative majority is there either. So we're into the three other scenarios. The third scenario is another familiar one from Canadian history, and you know, like me, many of you can remember back that far. In this scenario, the New Democrats have to gain more seats than the Liberals lose, which is a bit complicated because some of the seats New Democrats gain would be from Liberals, but the net figures have to be that the total for Liberals and New Democrats goes up. If that happens, and it doesn't need to go up very much, just four seats would do it. If that happens, then we're back into familiar territory. We all know in Canada that minority government always meant the Liberals, with the NDP holding a solid balance of power, creating a stable governing situation. And that's what we'd be in a position to accomplish if New Democrats can gain more seats than Liberals lose. Now, this situation is always stable. Bluntly, it always lasts as long as the Liberals find it convenient to last. Then they eat the NDP for breakfast and sweep back to majority government. So for the NDP, this is a moment of total... It's like the praying mantis making love, right? A moment of total ecstasy followed by death. But yeah, at least it's a stable picture. We've been here before. We know how it works. The trouble is, I don't see that one happening either. I think the, you know, NDP and Liberals might very well trade some seats, but I don't see their joint total going up enough to accomplish this, because again, it's got to go up by 4, 6, 8 seats to happen. I'm not sure, you know, it's possible if the Liberals really turn it around, hang on to everything in Ontario, and then gain more seats in BC than they lose in Quebec, they're well on the way to it. So, it's not impossible, but I'd put it down as a modest possibility. Okay, the fourth scenario, and the most likely one, and the reason I get depressed even, you know, in the middle of all this fun, is I think the Conservatives and the Bloc will both gain seats. In that case, the current balance of power in the 2004 House of Commons tips the other way. And instead of Liberals and New Democrats prevailing whenever they get together, this would be Conservatives and Bloc prevailing whenever they get together. Of course, the only thing they could get together on a stable basis is being mad at the Liberals. But once you've defeated them once and they've resigned, or, you know, then that fund isn't available for you anymore. And I think the both Duceppe and Harper made it quite clear in the leadership debate last night that the thought of hopping into bed together to share political power holds no attractiveness for either one. For one thing, Duceppe has way more political capital thumping Tories than helping them govern Canada. And for another, the Conservatives are perfectly aware that the Bloc has all kinds of priorities, and providing stable, effective government for Canada is pretty low down on the list. So for that double reason, neither one of the partners to this strange situation has any enthusiasm. So politics may make strange bedfellows, but not this strange. This scenario is complicated by, I think what we're watching is constitutional amendment by the media. I think the media is creating a new constitutional convention in Canada, and that is after any general election, the person who gets to be prime minister is the leader of the largest party. Now, as a person who's been teaching at the university for quite a while, and taught a number of you, you know perfectly well what mark that would have got you on any midterm I've ever given. That's an F. That's wrong. That's not how it works. That's not the rule. I think the media thinks it's the rule. Just listen closely to how they describe it. That if the swing toward the Conservatives stays where it is right now, the Conservatives will have a weak minority government. What a stupid sentence. No. The Conservatives will have a few more seats than the Liberals. That's all they mean. But they keep translating it wrong. They keep saying we'll be a minority government. Well, the answer to that is not necessarily. If you don't have a majority party in the House of Commons, then you're in a tricky situation, and it's up to the Governor General to help you find a way out of it with the cooperation of whatever political leaders want to play. That's the formula. It could be the second largest party, third largest party. Heck, it could be the smallest party. I mean, unlikely, but you know, it's not impossible. There is no rule based on number of seats makes you prime minister once you fail to get your majority. However, I think the media has created this expectation. If Paul Martin were to take one less seat than the Conservatives and then say that rather than hand over power to Stephen Harper, he is considering his options and will decide over the next few months, I think the media would lead the attack and public opinion would follow. I don't think he could get away with it. Not even one seat. If it's 5 seats, it's really game over. Mind you, in that situation, if I was Paul Martin, I couldn't give it away fast enough. But that's, okay, he's a different kind of animal for me, so we won't go there. I do think that complicates things because it means that instead of the Liberals trying to steer their, you know, with some experience in government over the last little while, trying to steer their way through the shoals, it'll be a brand new rookie bunch of Conservatives trying to find their way through the shoals. But I think that's where the media constitutional convention is taking it. Now, to me, this is the scariest scenario of all, because you would have a government in power in the shakiest possible situation. The Bloc would be holding the balance. Whenever the Bloc wanted to, they could jump in behind the Liberals and topple the government. Why would the Bloc want to do that? Referendum tactic. That's, you know, you'd have a weak government discredited in the province of Quebec, not able to mount a strong campaign anyway, and then constantly hampered by the fact that they could be brought down any day by a machination of a party that wanted them to fail. So to me, that's a terrible outcome. It doesn't mean we lose the referendum. It just means we all get a lot more gray hairs as we go through it. Now, there's a fifth scenario I would not even have contemplated when I was first asked to give this talk. But since the party leaders are now publicly talking about it, I'll entertain it as well. You know, what if both the NDP and the Conservatives gained seats such that their combined seat total was over 155? In that case, they could whenever they had a tacit arrangement, they could survive motions of confidence, they could pass legislation. And at the moment, they have just under 120 seats between them. We're talking about a gain of 36. It's not impossible. Personally, I don't think it's going to happen, but it's not impossible, depending where things go over the next couple of weeks. In that case, well, we've never had a conservative minority government based on a stable understanding with a new Democratic Party balance of power. Never tried that in Canadian history. So, of course, we're trying a lot of things these days we've never tried in Canadian history, so what's one more? I think both Harper and Layton have some incentive for it. Harper would want a conservative government to survive long enough to make some kind of an impression. He wouldn't want to be a 48-hour wonder. You know, he'd want some kind of legislative agenda out there for the public to respond to during the next election campaign. He'd want to survive long enough to put that up in view. Layton would want to avoid the cozy partnership, I don't think there is one, but Layton talks about it, between the conservatives and the Bloc, and all the horrible consequences that he said during the campaign would flow from that. Also, as Layton has been doing during this election campaign, he would love to be able to point to policy results that he had gained for the Bloc of New Democratic Party MPs who were smart enough to elect that time around. Next time around, give him more MPs, he can do more for you. And that would be the double incentive for them. It's not a very stable situation. I don't think either one of them would be remotely comfortable with it. But again, it's not impossible. As I say, though, I think the negative majority in the House of Commons, the Conservatives and the Bloc gaining seats and creating a situation in which no one party can hope to govern, I think that's the most likely outcome and the most unfortunate one for all of us.
Welcome back to the special session of the SACPA Thursday lunch, which happens to be happening today on a Tuesday. I think in the excitement of beginning last time, I forgot to tell you that my name is Susan Giffen, and I will be your moderator for the day. The meeting, as I said earlier, on Thursday, again, Paul Hinman. But we wanted to also tell you that on January 17th, and this has been handed to me by the program committee, so I'm just going to read it. On Tuesday, January 17th, we have organized a candidates forum from 7 to 9 at the Lethbridge Public Library. All candidates standing for election as our members of Parliament have agreed to participate. They will present the position of their party on the major issues and be there to answer your questions. We look forward to seeing you at the session and to listening to your questions and to the answers from the aspiring politicians. If you can't make it to this session, and this may be of particular interest to those of you who live out of Lethbridge, you can send in your questions by email. These should be sent to sacpa@sacpa.ca. Your email should state to which of the candidates your question is addressed and show your full name and the town in which you live. So that's for Tuesday, January 17th. On Monday, January 16th, SACPA itself is having an organizational-type meeting. It's to do some vision and mission statement development, 7:15 to 9 o'clock at MacKillop, and we would encourage any of you who are interested in helping us do that to attend. So, Peter, we'll call you back now for your question. And anybody wanting to ask a question, the question-asking mic is on the stage at the front here today.
After watching the debate last night and listening to Paul Martin bringing up a new platform for his for running about taking out the notwithstanding clause, what do you think about this maneuver?
To me, it smacked of desperation. It just came out of nowhere. He stumbled over it so badly. That was one of... by and large, our standard complaint now about leaders in debates is they're so well rehearsed. You know, you push the button and out comes the paragraph. You know? And that was about Gilles Duceppe was doing better in English than Paul Martin did at bringing out this blockbuster idea he's been dying to share with us for the entire election campaign. So that'd be the first point. He flubbed the delivery of what was supposed to be a critical turning point. Number two, he's the guy who just finished it during the same-sex debate, promising to use the notwithstanding clause to exempt religious denominations from being obliged to perform same-sex marriages if the Supreme Court were to rule that it was necessary. So you can't, one month you can't be the only prime minister who ever said, I am actively considering using the notwithstanding clause, and then in the next complaint that follows say, I am wrapping myself in never using the notwithstanding clause, and you must be some sort of vile bastard not to leap on with me right now. I mean, it smacked of desperation. It wasn't well thought through. It was too much of a single-point cheap shot. And if anything, I think that was one of the weak points of Paul Martin's evening. I thought Paul Martin had an excellent, I thought the debate was excellent. I enjoyed it far more than I expected to when I first sat down. I thought all of them were there and strutting their stuff. I've never seen Paul Martin that effective since he became leader of the Liberal Party, the thing you've been waiting for his whole life. He's never seemed to know what to do with it. Well, last night was the closest to him showing why he wanted to be leader, what he wanted to do with it, what he cared about. And there were some great moments in that debate. But that particular maneuver, it was just too contrived, just too opportunistic. And the media was on him right away for it, too. I think if that was his great turning point of the campaign, sorry, Paul, try again.
Howard Forsyth. A lot's been said in recent times about how volatile this is in the history of Canadian parliamentary. You've discussed five versions of volatility.
Well, last spring, one independent
who was both sick and old made a tremendous difference. Suppose there were a candidate somewhere who wasn't either sick or old running as an independent, what would be their role?
If you get it lucky and you're the odd person left out after a dead heat, a marvelous role. Normal functioning in the House of Commons, absolutely zip. So it's really a question of the moment and the opportunity. Chuck Cadman had the moment and the opportunity and was very much center stage. But first of all, you've got to create that absolute hair trigger balance. That's what makes the election of 2004 was so scary, and anything that replaces it is even scarier. It's because our party system is so badly broken that the best we can hope for is a thinly poised tie where an independent member from Vancouver winds up making critical decisions. It's a weird corner for our political system to have put us into. The famous story in the United States is the senator who voted not to impeach President Andrew Johnson, who replaced Abraham Lincoln. That motion failed by a single vote. That particular person was elected in his own run for office. He was elected by a single vote. So they always tell that story in the United States. Every single vote matters. So in a way, they've got us beat, but our example isn't bad either.
Heather Caldwell. And I just had two quick questions. One is that I was reading a report card from the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, and they talk about the value of having the minority government, and they're saying that for the sort of the greater good of your average Canadian, that it has been a great benefit to us. So I'm hoping that you can address that with some of your thoughts. And also, you had mentioned earlier about that they are sort of making promises outside of their jurisdiction. And I'm really hoping that you can come up with some kind of solution, some kind of jurisdictional manipulation, if you will, so that we can either bring the premiers on board or we can bypass them in some manner and send funds to municipalities, or is there some way to either get them to work a little better on board, work a little more universally, or bypass them?
Okay, first point about minority government. In many ways, I'm a fan of minority governments because it obliges governments to do what they're often accused of being bad at, is actually listening to voters. Because they never know when they're going to face the accounting and when they're going to have to be chatting with you again on the campaign trail. So they tend to mind their P's and Q's a lot better. Number one, they don't do some of the things that otherwise do. Number two, they try really hard to be explaining themselves in all the things they're doing. And I tend very much to welcome that. Especially in a system such as our own where the power has become so badly centralized within cabinet and within the office of the prime minister, a minority government is particularly advantageous. The problem is the minority governments that I tend to be happier about have the adjective stable in front of them. You've got to see a party configuration in the House of Commons that can give some reasonable prospect of that government being able to carry on for some period of time. It doesn't have to be the full 4 years. It could be a shorter time. And a terribly unstable government, one that every single vote is going to be a whoopee, let's keep our fingers crossed, that doesn't... That scares me more than it excites me. And that's what I was trying to talk about today, was to point out there's different kinds of minority government. And unfortunately, our experience in Canada has generally been with the stable kind. It's got some reason to stay there for a while. I think we may be about to explore the other kind of minority government, the one that really has no reason to live apart from temporary accident and is going to be darn lucky to survive very long at all. And that one worries me quite a bit more. As far as the point about federalism is a system that we designed in Canada over 100 years ago. It's operated in different ways at different periods. My point was to illustrate how the current phase of federalism, we need to develop a whole new set of language and a whole new set of mechanisms to allow it to work. Because anything approaching the old watertight division of powers is now simply absurd. It just won't work. And that's what this campaign demonstrates, is that provincial jurisdictional matters have national implications, and sometimes vice versa. But if you want to change the division of powers, we're talking constitutional amendment. How many people can say Brian Mulroney? How many people can say Meech Lake? How many people remember Charlottetown? Okay, let's not go there right away. I'd rather look for mechanisms that would engage the premiers in a more constructive way. That's what the Council of the Federation was supposed to be about. And its first real test was the meeting between the Prime Minister and the Premiers on health care just after the last election. And that was not a glorious outcome, but it was a survivable one. So I'd rather see us going that direction rather than turning us, as political scientists, to the constitutional lawyers loose to try to redraft the thing. John?
John Boris, sorry, I had to be careful. I think Gordon Campbell stumbled over here, and now I'm walking around. I fell at home. And keeping your feet under you is something becoming a problem when you're 82. Peter, thank you for your usual presentation, which is enjoyable. And one thing that I see is happening, and correct me if I'm wrong, they are going to have an election in BC May something this year? Because they've decided on a fixed election date. This is what I'm... Sure. Now, did they say that fixed election date still does not change the fact that government's going to fall? I think if we had a fixed date and no falling of government, whatever you got, you work with. The city council in Toronto, you probably know, has a council of in double figures, does it not?
Okay, definitely.
And they work. So why can't we just, for the time being, just have fixed election date, no government falls, you deal with it. It's a little muckier than, having a majority government, but this is what the electors wanted, and give it to them. Peter.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, the thing about changing the basic rules of the game is always a bit tricky, because any basic rule of the game that you're changing winds up benefiting somebody. If you say the government can't fall, you're basically saying Paul Martin gets to be Prime Minister no matter what happens in the House of Commons right through until the normal four-year life. At this particular moment, that would have been a massively pro-liberal thing to accomplish. Whenever you change the rules favor somebody. The only way that you can keep the game going at all with any sense of decency at all is if the rules remain constant, if they're only changed prospectively, not retrospectively. There are a lot of problems with the Westminster model. There are lots of problems with parliamentary government. The problem is you can't just fix one corner of it. Everything ripples through the whole system. So before you made that one move, maybe you need to be electing the Prime Minister separately. Maybe you need to go the Israeli route, because there's now, in the model you've suggested, there's no reason to be connecting the chief executive and the heads of government departments directly to the legislature any longer. That is the parliamentary model. So maybe you're talking congressional, or quasi-congressional. But the point is, it's not one simple change. You don't just say fixed election date, there, everything's okay now. You've got to think what other institutions have to be changed as a consequence, and you have to make sure you've looked at the whole set and you've thought through the linkages. Now, that, of course, that is an accident. Don't get political scientists started. If I had two of my colleagues here, we could take the next hour. But the point is, it's thin end of the wedge stuff. It's the first step of a longer journey. Maybe it is time to do away with the Westminster parliamentary model in Canada. But if you're going to do away with it in a more thoughtful way than simply changing one rule, because the operation of that rule at one moment has proven to be inconvenient to one set of people. That's the worst way to do it.
I have to be careful, too. They don't make stairs and stages for people my height. Thank you, Peter, for a wonderful presentation. My name is Hal Schroeder. My question is about proportional representation. You mentioned rather effectively that our system is broken, and I suspect that most people in this room agree with you. What do you think of it, first of all, and how likely is it to happen in Canada?
Okay, you're talking to a political scientist. I think all of us have electoral systems as our hobby, and all of us have the single-member plurality vote system as the boogeyman in the room that we all wish would go away. I would very much favor, my pet little horse in the barn is a single transferable vote, which strictly speaking is not proportional, but that's an argument. Okay, we won't. Yeah, some form of proportional representation, some mechanism of allowing voters to vote in a more flexible and meaningful way, and then which has some fairer way of translating voting preferences into members, I would definitely be in favor of. I think of all electoral systems you could devise, this one has got to be the worst. However, that said, you are constantly asking the winners under the current system to change the system under which they're winning. This is a hard sell. Normally, the only time you get a government actively contemplating major electoral reform is when they are facing certain death at the next election, when the polls make it clear that they are going to be setting records for humiliation anyway. So at that point, what the heck? You might just as well talk about changing the system. Unfortunately, everyone can work out exactly what you're doing and why you're talking about it, so it generally lacks credibility. So difficult to implement. Okay, one possibility I might be, suppose a party like the NDP, instead of making its deal in terms of a few billion dollars here, instead of making their deal in the terms they chose to do so, suppose they'd made a serious commitment to electoral reform, the price of keeping the Liberals in power for a bit longer. There's a way you might get it. So maybe this, the kind of moments we're going through now are our best opportunity. But somebody, your single independent or the leader of the balance of power party has got to seize the opportunity and make this the priority. And the trouble they'd face is it's a lot easier to stand up during the leaders' debate and point to, we had made sure money came for this, we made sure money came for that. If you give them a lecture on electoral reform, they all tend to doze off to sleep on you. It's not easy to explain why that's your top priority. But I don't see any other way it's going to happen in Canada in the foreseeable future. We actually had, there was a Lortie Commission on electoral reform about, 15, I've forgotten now, I wrote something for them, I've forgotten when it was. And the weird thing about that one was they were asked to look at every aspect of the electoral system except PR. Supposed to assume that we keep the single-member system in place, now let's talk about electoral reform. That's a neat trick. let's talk about an election, but don't mention political parties or something. You just can't do it. So, and in a way, that's the signal from the parties that tend to win. Don't muck up the way we win, because winning is more fun than losing. If you did have PR, you'd have to get used to the fact you'd never have a majority government. But then if you'd never have a majority government anyway, you'd stop posturing, maneuvering, and angling to get one. You'd never have the House of Commons change a whole lot in its composition and membership from one election to another, but that would just mean that opportunistic elections wouldn't be that big a deal, and there wouldn't be any great big pot of goodies to win for timing it just right or picking just the right issue and coasting into a whole bunch of plurality wins. It completely transforms politics, but again, that's my point. Don't ever think you're changing just one thing about a political system, because everything connects to everything else. And a whole lot of other changes come along with it. But I very much favor PR. I would love to join a crusade for PR anywhere, anytime. Just send me an email. I'm with you.
Thank you. My name is Don Ferguson. Thank you for your talk, Peter. Instead of the nice deep questions you've been asked, I have a rather trivial one. It relates to signage. There's nothing more that annoys me in elections is the signage that we see appearing and growing on this, on our public property and private property. The last provincial election we had here in Lethbridge, I was here and I noticed it at that time, and it's been the same in other elections. And so my question is this. There are three questions. I'd like to know, because I believe political scientists have studied this, are signs effective? Secondly, if they are effective, in what special circumstances, if any, are they effective? And lastly, I'd like to know if this mind-bogglingly dumb policy of my sign is bigger than your sign is effective.
What's ineffective is not to have signs. I mean, in a way, the signs are a second-level indication of something that parties want to display, and that is organization and support. If you've got lots of signs and they're splashed all over the place, number one, lots of people like you. Number two, your party is enough on the ball they can get signs out to the people that like you. If you have no signs out at all, either your organization is a bunch of morons, or else everybody hates you, or both. So it's in that very strange, backward sense, you know. By having signs, you prove that your organization isn't stupid and not everybody hates you. And if you can get a splash of signs, if you can create a circumstance in which it's your signs that clearly predominate in some area for some period of time, that can give a momentum advantage or be thought to give a momentum advantage. It's all very fuzzy stuff. I mean, what we do know mostly about electoral voting intention, it's based primarily on national considerations, not local. It's based primarily on national leader, national party, national issues. Not a lot of it revolves around the local campaign, let alone how many signs you had up on scenic drive.